Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. As we're recording, it is Tuesday, November 12th, 2013, just after 3 UTC. I'm Sam Minter, and Yvonne Bo is with me again. Hello, Yvonne.
Hello. Hey, by the way, I just remembered something.
Yes?
My wife said that she was going to send you feedback, did she?
I'm going to say I didn't see anything, but at the same time, I haven't been good about checking email in the last few days. So I'm just scanning through my email real quick.
My wife had not been listening really to my podcast before. Okay. Uh-huh. She decided to listen to our podcast.
My wife doesn't listen either. And I told her she should listen because, like, last week, Alex talked for, like, 5 minutes. But, no, I don't think she does.
My wife had not. And then, get this. So the funniest thing, she finally listened to it. And guess what? She liked it, by the way.
There you go.
Of all things, okay? She's like, damn it, I didn't listen to it. You know, she said it's good. And I'm like, okay, so that's good. And then she had some beef about something. The way you said it, I don't recall what it is. And I said, well, you heard a podcast, send feedback. Okay. So
now
I'm
looking through my folder of mail that doesn't make it through my inbox, and I don't see anything there, and I didn't get anything in my inbox.
Okay.
Either,
all right. Maybe she forgot. I'll see if at some point we'll get. She had some feedback. Maybe if she listens again, okay, this week, maybe this will be a reminder for her to send a feedback.
There you go. So anyway, we have a plan today. Unlike last week where we were like, we have nothing. And we ended up talking for an hour anyway about various things. But, you know, there was nothing in the news. This time we have a few things. First of all, I've mentioned a couple times on Twitter in the last week being a little bit upset with my son's pre-K, my son's preschool. Speaking of whom, he's got a Nestle Crunch bar. Those are yummy.
Mommy got a little bit and I got more.
Oh, very nice. Thank you for showing me your Nestle Crunch bar and making me hungry. Okay. I've tweeted a couple things about some issues with the preschool, but I have not been specific in Twitter. I'll get a little bit more specific here.
How old is Alex Matt now?
He turned 4 in September.
Okay.
So 4 and 2 months. Actually, to the day, 4 and 2 months. And then we're going to talk about Iran and nukes and the talks that have been going on there and what the current state of them is. And, you know, we actually had an election last week. We didn't talk about it at all here because, you know, there were some races in New Jersey and Virginia that perhaps had national significance. Other than that, across the country, it was mostly local stuff. I mean, here in my own, you know, I voted. I had an election. But it was all, like, local stuff, you know, school boards and county commissioners.
There was actually in Boca.
Whatever. Yeah, you know, local stuff.
There was actually, in my town, there was not anything up for vote. There was no voting. I do recall this because I was like, oh, they're talking about election. I'm like, we had nothing.
Yeah, we did have a couple of statewide initiatives too, aside from the local stuff. And you know, anyway, we'll talk about elections. And then we had some news about they exhumed Yasser Arafat's body and did some tests on it and basically determined that there's a very high probability the guy was poisoned and that's why he died. So we'll talk a little bit about that. On the local elections, we'll talk about the parts of it that had national implications later. You know, all I can say is on all these local races, I always am a little bit frustrated because, like, I don't really understand in great depth, like, the local issues. And then when I go on, like, these candidates' websites and stuff, it's all mostly, there are some exceptions, but it's, like, generic pablum. Like, you have a couple different candidates saying that they'll be for the people and they care about your kids' education.
Right.
You know, okay. And you try to do a little bit of research online, and sometimes you can find a little, sometimes you can't.
Well, I'll give you a local listen. Recently, I was paying attention to one local race because it got very confusing. It wasn't in my town, like I said, there wasn't anything up for vote, but in the city of Miami Beach, there was one. And Miami Beach in South Florida drives a lot of economic activity. And the one thing is that there was a ballot initiative regarding the Miami Beach Convention Center, which, as you can understand, being a place that draws quite a lot of tourism, quite an important thing. And there was a multi-billion dollar development. And the thing is, it's just like you mentioned, there is this one guy on the county commission that was against it. I went through his website and through everything about him. I can't understand why. I can't figure it out. I'm trying to pull everything, and I am like, the guy's filing lawsuits and doing all this stuff. I'm trying to find anything. Why is the guy against it? You cannot find anywhere in his campaign, paraphernalia, his thing, anything, why the hell the guy's against it. And I'm like, well, how the fuck am I supposed to make a decision about this?
Yeah, I mean, and like, you know, okay, so I took a couple pictures of my ballot before I sent it in, and it's all by mail here in Washington, which is awesome. But we had two statewide initiatives. There was one on the way referendums work, and there was one on labeling GMO foods. Then there were these advisory votes, which are basically places where the legislature increased taxes and they ask for a vote to sort of ratify whether we think that's okay. And they're advisory votes, so I'm not sure they actually mean anything or not. But you know, but it was interesting. On everything else, there's this voter pamphlet, and it gives you more details and more information, and you have the people who are for or against give little explanatory statements about why they're for and against. And they're usually these statements usually aren't all that great, but at least it's something. For these advisory votes, there was no additional information at all. So, you know, it's things like the legislature extended, without a vote of the people, a state tax on certain property transfers and increased rates for estates over $4 million, costing approximately $478 million in the first 10 years for government spending. This tax increase should be repealed or maintained. And that's all you know about it.
Okay, well,
Presumably I could do some research and find out some more, but, you know, or I could just say all taxes are bad and say repeal, repeal, repeal. But I usually like to know more than that, you know?
I figured you would say all taxes are good. No? Okay.
You know what I did actually? Like, I voted to repeal the ones that were straight up and up increases, but I voted to maintain the ones that were eliminating loopholes.
Okay, I see what you're saying. So if it was a loophole, you were okay.
Yeah, if it was eliminating an exemption, I was like, that's cool. Eliminate all the damn exemptions.
If you're saying the rate went from 7% to 8%, you're like, no.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And basically that's how I made my decision, you know?
Well, it is a criteria, I guess.
Yeah, I usually like to know more than that, but I figured at least, you know, that's something. But at the same time, on the ones that were like eliminating some exemption that some portion of the people were able to take, I'm like, screw it, eliminate all the exemptions. You know, make taxes, everybody pays blah percent, and then argue over the percentage. Don't do all this crap where you can exempt this thing or that thing or whatever. Anyway,
right.
And then the other ones we had. County council, a couple places on the county council, and then what is the other one? Then we had school district director at large, two positions. We had fire district commissioner, three positions, and then we had the water and sewer commissioner position. And of course, two of those positions were uncontested, and so I do what I always do, and whenever there's an uncontested race, just out of principle, I write myself in, because I think there should always be competition.
So you're right. Well, that's good. So you're writing yourself in. That's great.
Whenever there's only one candidate.
So what happens if you win one of these?
I say
maybe even the guy that ran forgets to vote for himself. So you therefore, you're.
I think
you win.
That would be highly unlikely, but if so, I guess I would serve.
I mean, think about it.
Sometimes I'm blatantly not qualified for some of these things.
It's an uncontested race. Nobody votes for the guy, and oh, by the way, the guy who was running gets into a car accident and doesn't make it to the voting booth.
Uh-huh.
And then you win.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be interesting.
Every once in a while when I'm running for, like, you know, state Supreme Court or something like that, you know, that would be interesting. You know, I can't say, like, you know, if I suddenly won the water and sewer commissioner, I mean, okay. Not that I know a damn thing about that.
Oh my god, that would just be way too hilarious if you were the water and sewer commissioner. That would just be epic.
But you know, I did notice, however, when you look for fire commissioner, you know, there were several people running for fire commissioner, and about half of them didn't appear to have any experience whatsoever with anything fire related.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I think discuss this, you know, how for the Supreme Court, people are, you know, most people are selected as candidates that are judges or lawyers or whatever. But there is no prerequisite whatsoever for that, to serve.
In most places, that is a very state by state, locality by locality kind of issue. Whether in some places there are qualifications for some of these offices, like you must have experience in the relevant area or you must be a lawyer or something like that. Now, for the federal Supreme Court, there's no requirement that Supreme Court judges have previously been judges or even are lawyers.
But
history has it. There has not been a non-lawyer on the Supreme Court in like over 100 years or something. I don't know the exact number.
That's correct. That's correct. But I'm just stating that it's not, you know, it's by the book. It's not really required.
Right. Just like the Speaker of the House of Representatives does not actually have to be a member of Congress.
That's right. I forgot about that. That's also a correct one. Yes.
Yeah, they could pick whoever they want, you know?
Yep.
Anyway, so now that we've gone on that tangent for a while, Yvonne wanted to know about what my beef is with the preschool.
Yes, what is your beef with the preschool?
So let me give a little bit of history here, and this will all make sense as it all goes together. So we have Alex at a preschool that's associated with the local YMCA. We moved him there. You know, before we moved from Bellevue to Everett, he was at a preschool associated with where my wife was going to school. But then we moved up here. We looked around. We found, you know, the one that was associated with the Y. It looked clean. It looked nice. It looked good, you know, whatever. And so we're like, okay, that looks great. Let's put him there. And so when he first got there, you know, it was new. It was an adjustment. Like the first couple months, you know, he didn't like it just because it was new. It was a new place. It was different. But he got used to it. He made some friends. He was doing really well. And he got to the point where at the end of sort of his first year in preschool there, you know, he was happy to go in. He was walking on his own. Yeah, like, yeah, when they don't want to go, they like make you carry them in because they don't want to go, you know?
I've seen that, yes.
Yeah, and but like, you know, he's walking on his own. He's waving goodbye. He's like, okay, and he was having a good time. And he had some friends there, and he would talk all the time about his friends, whatever. Then this last June, at the end of the last school year, was the time that they shift people to new classes, right? And here's the thing. Alex missed the cutoff date by age to go into pre-kindergarten by 12 days. So what happened here then is his entire preschool class, except for him, went to pre-kindergarten. He was... So all of his, I think there might have been one other kid left behind, but it wasn't one of his friends. So all of his friends, all of the people he knew and hang out with and spent time with, moved up from preschool to pre-K. He was left as, and like I said, maybe this other kid. I'm not even sure there was another kid, but just for the sake of argument, let's say there was one other kid. They were left behind. And then all of the two-year-olds came up. So he went from being...
But wait.
Yes.
But if he was already in that class, that doesn't make any sense.
So they let him in that class to begin with, not by...
Can't they do an exception? We're talking 12 days.
So let me talk. First of all, he was in that class in the first place, even though because to get into preschool, Mm-hmm. There was an age limit that he was over, but it was also a lot about, like, you know, you had to be toilet trained and stuff. And so we actually did a major push right before he turned 3 to get him toilet trained in time to get into that class. Okay.
Okay.
And so we did that and he was good and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, so they moved up the younger kids. And so he went from being the youngest one in the class to being the oldest one in the class. Mm-hmm. And so he was, and all of a sudden they brought in these younger kids. And I don't know what happened with our requirement that he had to be toilet trained to be in the class, because they brought in a bunch of kids who weren't even toilet trained yet. Some that were still in diapers, some that were in pull-ups. But anyway, then what they do with the kids went from, hey, we've got a class of a bunch of 4-year-olds to, oh, we've got a class of a bunch of, you know, 2- and 3-year-olds. And so all of a sudden, not only did all of his friends move, but the level at which they were teaching and dealing with the kids dropped by like a year.
Yeesh.
And also, to top this off, at the same time, his teacher left.
I still don't understand. Why couldn't they make an exception to keep him together with the class he was in?
So we're getting to that. So the rest, and his favorite teacher left also at the same time.
Okay.
So now here's what happened. So basically, as we're leading up to this time, they're like, you know, okay, the classes are going to change. Some of the kids are going to go up to pre-K and some of them won't. And we didn't realize at the time that it was like everybody. It took us like a week or two to realize everybody was gone. And there were all of these younger kids in there. But what happened is he started getting more and more unhappy. He didn't want to go to school anymore. He started having accidents again, which he hadn't had for months and months and months. He started regressing in a whole bunch of different ways. Because guess what? He was acting like the younger kids that were in his class.
Right.
As opposed to the older kids that he'd been with before. And so, this was at home too, not just at school. Like, you know, he'd literally, like, it had been months and months before, since he'd had any sort of accident. And I'm talking potty accidents here.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it was happening multiple times a day. It took us a while to put 2 and 2 together and figure out what was going on. So we were like, maybe he's got a urinary infection. Let's take him to the doctor. You know, let's do this. We're trying to figure it out. And at the same time, he's getting more and more and more unhappy. And then after a few weeks, I realized, oh, this is what happened. His whole class left. He's the only one left. All of these little kids came in, and it's now all of a sudden incredibly boring for him, and he's regressing because he's around all of these younger kids. So then we did exactly what you said. We're like, okay, let's talk to the school about it. Let's say,
right,
what the hell's going on here? Now, first of all, they probably should have been thinking something on their own. It's a warning sign to me that they were just basing it off the calendar and nothing else to begin with.
Right.
Because I talked to one of his teachers first, and the teacher was like, yeah, I don't even know why he's still here. He should have moved up there. And then we said, well, he wasn't even 4 yet. And she's like, oh, I didn't even realize he was that young because he was acting older, you know? And then we went to talk to the management of the school, and they're like, we got a little bit of a runaround. We got a hem ha. Like, the person who's normally in charge was on maternity leave, and we got like the whoever was second in command or whatever. It took us a while to actually get in front of them to talk to them, and then they're like, "Oh, okay. Well, I think you're gonna need." Actually, the first thing they said is, "I'm gonna need to talk to all of his teachers to understand what's going on." Okay. And we're like, "Okay, go talk to his teachers. We understand." And then we came back a couple days later, and they're like, okay, did you talk to the teachers? And they're like, oh, no, I didn't get a chance. And, you know, one of the teachers that's with him the most is on vacation right now, so we're going to have to wait for her to get back. And we're like, okay. And so then, like, you know, another week, whatever, goes by. And then that the second-in-command person finally talks to whoever they needed to talk to.
Yeah.
At least theoretically. I now... not sure they really did. But so they go and talk to him. And then they say, well, you know, we can't really just move him up because they're requirements of the state and blah, 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 blah. You need to get a doctor's note that says he's developmentally ready or whatever. And we're like, okay. And short story, we had the doctor's note 24 hours later. So okay. We go in and we turn in the doctor's note. And they're like, oh, like they weren't expecting us to actually get one. You know?
Idiots.
And so then she's like, okay, well, I'm not sure exactly what to do here. And, you know, what's her name is going to be back from maternity week next week. Let's wait for her to get back.
Oh, God.
So then we're like, okay, you know, he's really unhappy now. But okay, we'll wait a few more days. So she comes back.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's like, well, I have to talk to everybody.
Did you? And I'm like, God, again?
Well, because okay. It's a different person now. And I'm right. Like, well, your other person talked to him. And she's like, well, I have to talk to him. And then, she said, okay, I need a couple days. A couple days, we asked, she hadn't done it yet. A couple more days, we asked, she hadn't done it yet. A couple more days, we finally get, she's like, I talked to them. Let's sit down and talk. And then she talks to, and says, well, you know, I've talked to them and they're concerned that he's not really ready to move up. And I'm like, have you talked to any of the teachers who saw him before this change? And the answer was no. She'd only talked to the teachers who'd seen him after he started regressing.
Oh my God, what a fucking moron.
Right.
Jesus
and so we're okay. and
I'm getting the picture. Okay.
And so then, well, it gets worse. So then we're talking to her and she's like, you know, okay, well, look, you know, the state has all these requirements to doing kindergarten early, and we generally don't recommend that. And here's all the possible downsides of moving somebody up a class from where they're quote unquote supposed to be. And, you know, in terms of, the, you know, and they're
okay.
All,
at which point did you just go say, listen, you fucking moron. Okay. All right. What the hell's the matter with you? Are you on crack?
We basically said, we understand the risks. We want to do it anyway.
Right.
And she's like, okay, but you know, here's the thing. We don't have the staffing right now in the other class. We've hired a new person, but we have to wait for their background check to come back before they're allowed to be in the class alone, you know? And so he can't move up there until that happens. How long is that going to be? It could be tomorrow. It could be a couple weeks. We're like, okay. Yeah. And so we wait a little while and, you know, he's still going to the other class every day. He's still going to the other class every day. That takes a little while. One day we get to school and they're like, go ahead and take him to the other class. And we're like, great. He's in the other class now. Finally. And this had taken from the time, that we, from the beginning of the summer, it took us maybe a month before we got in front of these guys the first time. It probably took another month, maybe a little bit more before they agreed to move him up. And then it took the rest of the summer, essentially, before they were ready to move him into the other class. So basically, the entire summer, he was in a class he was miserable with.
Jesus.
Okay, now, as many times as we could, we sort of played hooky and took him out somewhere, took him to the zoo, whatever, instead. But, you know, we didn't want to pull him out entirely because, A, we need the space, and, B, like, if you even dropped him to part-time or something, you lose your spot, potentially. So anyway, so they finally moved him in sort of towards the beginning of the school year, around September-ish. Mm-hmm. They moved him into the new class. And, you know, the very first day he was a little bit unsure of himself. But then the second day he was excited. He was running in. He was happy to be there. Like, he came to the class and all of the other kids who knew him from the other class were like, Alex, you're in our class now. Yay, Alex. And they all came around and hugged him and stuff. And he was having a good old time and basically enjoying himself in the new class. He was once again, like, he stopped having accidents. He started being happy to go to school again. Well, he'd still rather stay home, but he was okay. He wasn't fighting it. He wasn't doing whatever.
Right. Okay.
And then over the course of, and that brings us up to, like, end of September. So over the course of October, he started getting more resistant to school again. And we're like, and you know, he started, you know, asking us not to take him to school. He wanted to stay home, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't as bad as it was over the summer, but it was slowly getting worse over the course of the time period. So then Friday we had, you know, parent-teacher conferences. You know, they do that every few months, whatever.
Yeah.
So Friday we had parent-teacher conferences. And we get in there, and the first thing the teacher says is, okay, here's my evaluation, but, you know, I wasn't able to do a very good evaluation because I haven't seen Alex very much. And we're like, what?
What do you mean?
And she's like, well, because he gets bumped down so often. And we're like, what?
What?
And she's like, well, you know, because I'm often alone here. I don't have the second teacher. And so I'm only allowed to have this many students in my class. And we have this many more. So we take the youngest ones and send them back to preschool.
For the love of God.
And so what happened was, the first 2 weeks after he moved up in the class, he was actually there. He was actually enjoying it. He was having fun. But then apparently almost every day since those first 2 weeks, they've essentially, we've dropped him off in the morning, and 10 to 15 minutes later, they've been taking him out of that class and moving him back to preschool. And never once did they tell us this was happening. And Alex had mentioned being in the preschool class, but what happens is at the end of the day, when most of the kids have already been picked up, they combine the whole school together into the preschool room. So we thought, yeah, well, yeah, you're in the preschool class at the end of the day. But what was actually happening is he was there almost all day, almost every day. Back to that class that he hated, which was why he was getting worse and worse and more upset and starting to revert, revert in his behaviors again, like, you know, and everything from the potty stuff to, you know, using less complete sentences and starting to babble more and things like this, all because he was imitating the kids he was with all the time. And fighting a lot about getting ready to go to school, going to school in the morning, did not want to do it. And the teacher's like, you know, look, my hands are bound. I've been telling management this. And then we also asked, well, you know his history, right? And she's like, what history? And it turns out that all of this stuff that we'd gone back and forth to get him moved into her class in the first place,
they
never even told her.
Good. Okay. Okay.
So the bottom line of all this.
This place sucks.
Well, yeah. So you know, and we'd been really. This is our second year here. The first year was good, but like they're clearly mismanaging all kinds of things here. You know, they're not. I mean, like if nothing else, okay, I understand. Maybe every once in a while you're short-staffed and you have to move the kids around a little bit because there are legal restrictions on the kid-to-student ratio.
Class size.
You know? Okay. Every once in a while you have to move stuff around. But, A, you should probably tell the parents whenever it happens. But, B, even if you don't – even if it happens once in a long time and you don't tell the parents, I can kind of understand that. But if it's happening every freaking day – and apparently it's not just him. There were like four kids that were getting moved every day. Because they just take the youngest kids, it was the same kids every day that it was happening to, not like they were rotating it in some way or shifting it around. It was the same kids who were getting screwed every day by going in with the younger age group than where they were supposed to be. You tell the parents, and frankly, if it's happening every day, you've got a major problem that you should be dealing with. You know, if it happens every once in a while because somebody's sick or whatever, and you have to, okay, you know, that's understandable. But if you're doing it almost every day for over a month, there's a serious issue there. And so, the fact that there was no communication, so that there was no, you know, okay, Alex is in this class because his parents had serious concerns about him being in the other class because it was causing behavior issues. And so you should know that, by the way, when you move up and when you're thinking about, okay, what kids am I going to bump each day? You know, somebody should be thinking about that. And no, clearly nobody was. And so we got out of the meeting Friday and we were just furious. absolutely furious because we went through this whole thing this summer to get him back where he belonged.
I know.
And it worked. It worked instantly. Within like 2 to 3 days, he was happy again after having been miserable all summer. And then he starts getting miserable again, and we didn't know why he was miserable again. And then we were in this meeting, and it all clicked together. It's because they're putting him back in that damn class. And, you know, that class was fine when he was 2.5, 3 years old, but it was not fine when he's over 4 and ready to move on. You know,
okay, so like, here's a question. Here's a question.
Yes.
What are your options?
So here's what we've been doing. Well, first of all, we're of course going to send a bitchy note to the school and CC like the people's bosses up the chain. You know, not his actual teacher, because she was like practically begging us to please complain so that she could get some help.
Okay.
But like the management of that school, and then it's like it rolls up into a larger countywide organization, I guess. And so we'll try to go up the chain a little bit and complain about this. But you know, frankly, even if tomorrow they came and said, you know, we're sorry, we screwed up, we'll make sure it never happens to Alex again. Guess what? We don't trust them anymore.
Right.
And also, we found out, by the way, he's got asthma just like I do. So he's got inhaler there. And a couple times over the last month, too, I picked him up and he was having issues. And as it turns out, they never actually gave him his meds when he was having issues like that. Brandy was talking to him this afternoon, and they're like, well, how are we supposed to tell he needs it? I'm like, you got to be kidding me, you know? And of course, you know, we filled out all the stupid forms about that when we first turned him in, you know, when we first got him here. I mean, and it was never bad enough that he needed to go to the ER or something, but it was bad enough so he was wheezing and coughing, and a couple puffs of his inhaler would have made him fine again, you know? But he spent who knows how much time without that. And I got there, I picked him up, and I'm like, oh, you need your meds. And I gave it to him, and he was fine, like, you know, 60 seconds later. So all of this. So anyway, we don't trust them anymore is the problem. So, you know, we're going to send the bitchy note, and we're going to see what they say. But, you know, I took most of today off, and I'll probably take some more time later in the week. We're basically shopping for a new place to send them.
But here's a question. What are your options? I mean, why did you originally pick this place? And I mean, I take it you're probably going to revisit some of the places that you had not considered before or that you didn't choose before.
You know, I don't know that most of the initial evaluation was done by Brandy. I wasn't heavily involved in it, but she'd done a good job in picking the place we had in Bellevue. It worked out really well. She did a bunch of looking around at what was available around here, and she ended up picking this. And I was like, I didn't spend a lot of time looking at other places. I visited this place and was like, oh, it looks great, looks clean, it looks like they've got good activities, blah blah blah. And frankly, the entire first year he was there, we were pretty happy with it. Like the first couple months he was there, there were a couple of adjustment issues, but it didn't seem like that was anything that was their fault. It was like adjusting to a new place kind of things. But the first year we were pretty happy. And then all of a sudden all this happened in the last few months. And so like, it's not like we got there initially. I mean, he's been at this school. He's 4 now. He started at this school when he was had just turned 2, you know, so it's been a while. Actually it was a little bit later than he started at the school when he turned 3, I guess, when he turned, or maybe a little bit before, around there. So the first, almost a year we were happy. It wasn't like we went there and it was very obvious very soon that there was problems. So anyway, we're looking at other places. We visited 2 places today. And of course we have the issue that my wife liked one of them and I like the other one.
You can wrestle for it.
Yeah, we can wrestle for it. And we've been looking, and we're probably going to look at 2 or 3 more places over the course of this week, and then make a decision of where to go. And of course, part of this is limited, of course, by which places have space. I mean, some of the places we call are like, you know, sorry, we're full. Anyway. So that's what's going on, and I've talked way longer than I intended to about that. But yeah, it's been, you know, we're just really pissed off by this. You know, and it's like, really? I can't. Yeah, the least you could have done is when he's getting bumped back to the other class, tell us.
I mean, that's the irritating thing. I mean, really, you spent the whole day of summer arguing with him about this. Oh, yeah, we just did it again. You know, just because. Really? You fucking asshole.
And frankly, they knew during the summer that if they weren't going to move him to pre-K, we were going to move him out. I mean, they knew that.
That's just irritating. That's just irritating. Well, good luck in your search for a new pre-K. I don't know. I'm hoping, you know, we hopefully my wife has taken my son to mommy and me to the same place where he's probably going to be going to.
Yep.
To there in the future. So, you know, we kind of like picked the school out of from that criteria. So.
Well, and the one thing to remember this, and we went through this with Amy when she was younger too, is you unfortunately can't take it for granted that the people at these places will be doing everything you think they should be in terms of, you know, communication and telling you when there's a problem and all of this kind of stuff. You got to ask.
Yeah.
You got to ask, and you got to ask on a regular basis. So you can't just say, how's everything, once every 3 months. You know, you have to, on a regular basis, be talking to them and asking what's going on. And, you know, with this kind of thing, it's difficult too, because like we drop him off fairly late in the day and we pick him up fairly late in the day usually. And so like, it's not always his like main teacher who's there at the end of the day when you pick him up. So it's harder to ask what's going on, you know? But you need to make the effort anyway, because you never know. If you don't ask, you don't know. That's the bottom line. You can't assume that the teacher or whoever is going to come to you and tell you about something when there's, I mean, they undoubtedly will if there's a really major issue. But, you know, if it's just like things that are, they may or may not notice, and they've got other kids running around, you know, you have to ask. That's the bottom line. Okay, enough about that. Sorry for all you guys who are bored by that stuff, but, you know, hey, a little bit of the home stories and, you know, a little personal character every once in a while here. And, oh, by the way, if anybody listening, and I know there are a couple of you out there who are somewhat local to where I am, if any of you have any specific recommendations for, you know, pre-K programs that you've had good experiences with, yeah, send them my way. Email me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com. We'd love the recommendations of additional places to check out. Anyway, that's it. Let's take a break, and we'll be back after this, and we'll talk about you know, some of that other stuff. We'll be back. Bring me the elephant. Bring me the elephant. Bring me the elephant. Bring me the elephant.
Information.
Okay, we're back. So, you know, we've got three things left, and since we took so much time on that, we've got Iran nukes, Arafat, and the 2016 possibles. Let's do Iran and Arafat, because I think they're the smaller of the two. I don't know, maybe not. And
who knows?
Anyway. Let's talk about it. Let's just start with Iran. So, we've had peace talks going on last week. John
peace
Kerry,
talks? Peace talks?
Not peace talks.
Peace
well,
talks?
Effectively, I mean, I know we're not like actively bombing.
We're not at war with them.
Well, effectively, I mean, you know, frankly, economic sanctions are actually an act of war, but they were sanctioned. In many cases, they were sanctioned by the UN. So, you know, whatever. Anyway, John Kerry interrupted whatever else he was doing and went to participate personally in these talks. And it sounded like they made potentially a bunch of progress, but didn't quite come to a deal. So they're meeting again at a lower level in a couple of weeks.
Well, listen, let's just, you know, let's get a grip here. Okay, guys. I mean, really. I mean, we've come from, how long ago was it that we had absolutely no diplomatic direct contact with Iran? How long was it? A month ago? 2 months ago?
Uh-huh.
2 months ago, right? I mean, you know, we have like, I mean, how quickly you guys want a deal? I mean, I think that some people have been like, you know, they've gotten close, but I expected, to be honest with you, okay, not so much from our end, but I expected significant infighting inside Iran about whether to reach a deal or not. I really did, because a lot of the things that drove this, I mean, are things that historically have been the independence of Iran. Like one of the things I heard today, for example, I mean, you know, it should be our right to develop a nuclear weapon. Why can't anybody else do? Why can't we? So forth and so on. There's a lot of things about independence and other things historically, the animosity that we've had, that I would think that, you know, a deal wouldn't be cut so quickly.
Well, I think part of this, though, I mean, and, you know, people poo-poo sort of the elections in Iran, that they're not really democratic because the sort of Ayatollah's pick who is even going to be able to run. So it's only an election among people they approve of to start with. However, having said that, the fact that they let him run, the fact that they let him win, indicates right. that the religious leaders of Iran are also ready for something to change, because these sure. sanctions have been painful over these years, and they're, you know, they recognize something has to give.
And absolutely, and there's been a lot of, I mean, and it's caused a lot of pain, to the people of the average Iranian, and a lot of people are upset about it. I mean, they just are.
And frankly, the the Iranian religious leaders have been absolutely consistent that they don't want nuclear weapons anyway.
Right.
I mean, obviously, we think we have intelligence that, you know, hey, they really are working on it anyway. But the religious leaders, who are the ones in charge there, have been absolutely consistent that they believe nuclear weapons are against the tenets of Islam and should not be built and should not be used.
But obviously, it's been happening. This process has been there for a long time. There's yep. been many reasons for it. So therefore, there has to be a number of people who were for it.
Well,
so therefore,
the word has always been, hey, these are for peaceful nuclear energy.
Correct.
You know, and I don't know, maybe not. Maybe you're right. Maybe there was a faction within the Iranians who was always doing this anyway. And that's quite plausible. I don't want to deny that that's plausible. But, you know, maybe they really were just after nuclear energy. I don't know.
Maybe they were
after, like a number of countries are. I don't like saying I don't actually want to have nuclear warheads ready, but I want to have the capability so that if I ever decide I do need them, I have that option.
I think the one thing is, Sam, I mean, you know, after what are we talking about? The other day I saw the movie Argo. Okay, you know, they had it on TV. We're talking about the kind of animosity that we have between the two countries for, like, what, 30-plus years? I just don't think you negotiate it away in, like, 1 month.
No, no. And you know, and frankly, there's the what was I going to say? You might even have some of the Saddam Hussein effect here. Like, Saddam Hussein, in fact, had gotten rid of all of his chemical weapons, you know, right after the Iran-Iraq War, or after First Gulf War, or very
right,
early
and
on.
Apparently,
but
yeah.
He was bluffing the whole time. He wanted everybody to think he still did have them.
That's right.
And, of course, that led to his downfall. It fooled the Bush administration, but he was bluffing the whole damn time. He didn't have a damn thing.
Well, let me just say, fooled, I'm sorry, the Bush administration had quite a lot of credible evidence showing that they didn't have any, but they chose to believe Saddam and, you know, whatever flimsy crap they pulled together.
Well,
okay,
and
all right.
Along those same times, I don't know if you remember, every once in a while, there's a publicly released official assessment of the intelligence community on Iran's nuclear capability. And it always, right. every single time, has been a lot less alarmist and a lot more, yeah, they're doing some stuff, but they're actually a long way from anything real that's not really much to worry about. That's the official assessment of, like, the CIA and stuff. It's all these other pressure groups who are like, we have to be a lot more paranoid about this. But
I totally agree about that. I am with you 100%. But I mean, because one of the things I've said about this whole thing is, like, great. I mean, even if they get a nuke, I mean, what the hell are they going to do with it? I mean, I don't know. Just the
well, we've said this before. I mean, you know, as insane as it is, mutually assured destruction worked.
Yes, it did.
You know, India and Pakistan both have nukes. They have not gone into a serious war since they both got nukes. It has prevented them from nuking themselves, nuking each other. It looks like it's prevented conventional wars.
Right.
Because the fact that they both have them makes them a lot more reluctant to get into a shooting war because it might escalate. And, you know, the same thing might occur here. I don't know. But, like, I'm not saying I want to encourage Iran to get nuclear weapons, but, you know, but it's a complicated issue. And one of the things that you have to do is put yourself in Iran's point of view. They're surrounded by potential enemies. And yes, there's Israel, but even the Arab states around them, Iraq, you know, Pakistan, whatever.
Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia. These are all countries that don't particularly like Iran. So it's understandable that they want weapons to be able to defend themselves.
And let me look in a perverse way.
And they know they would potentially have problems in a conventional war if they go up against countries that are backed by the West.
Listen, in a perverse way, for a while, except that the economic sanctions, the problem that the problem that they've had for a while, it did help them to a certain extent. Okay, economically. Because let's face it, the threat of them having a nuclear weapon was driving up the price of oil. Okay.
Right.
Now, what's happened in the last, I think what really put the screws in Iran, okay, economically, was if I remember correctly, is that they removed them from SWIFT. Okay. All right. SWIFT is this global system for banking interchange, which allowed transfers of money. And they had been using the system in order to be able to move funds through third countries. Well, SWIFT booted Iran off, okay? And it made it incredibly difficult for them to move money around.
Right.
And I've been hearing about this, that this is something that all of a sudden they took them by – they just did not expect, okay? And I think that that sanction really pushed them over the brink on the said – screw this, great. So maybe us bluffing about nukes got price of oil over $100 a barrel. It's like all fine and dandy. But you know what? If we can't get any money, we're fucked from anything. And make it incredibly difficult. Let's just start moving money in suitcases is quite difficult.
Just to speak to what your quote was about, you know, hey, how much we've moved in a very short time after so much time not talking. A tweet came up from BBC News while we were talking with an interview they did with Secretary of State John Kerry. And the two quotes for him were, one, we are very, very close to reaching a deal. And two, we have talked more in 30 hours than we have in 30 years.
Exactly, guys. Give me a break, people. Come on.
Now, of course, the other criticism that's coming out is people saying we're giving up too much without getting enough concessions from Iran.
Oh, God.
You know, because we're potentially letting them off the hook for certain types of sanctions, and we're getting them to potentially slow down or pause on some things, but not actually roll them back. But, listen, you know, Kerry's quote on that, and I think it's important, is actually, any reports you may have heard about what this deal is are premature. We haven't made a deal yet. We're still talking. We have not come to an agreement. Yeah, you know, So, you know, criticism about we're giving up too much. Well, we don't know what we're giving up yet. Because, like, one of the reasons we, quote unquote, haven't come to a deal yet is we haven't come to something that satisfies both sides yet. But you certainly get the feeling from the people who are saying we're giving up too much that the only agreement that they would actually be okay with, and probably not even then, to be honest, is complete unconditional surrender by the Iranians without any concessions.
Yeah, but those guys are idiots. And you know what? I mean, those people are not understanding the fact that, let me put it this way, the last 30 days, price of oil has dropped a huge amount because of diffusing of this tension there, okay? That a drop in oil, I can't remember like how much of an economic boost it would be to a lot of economies if oil dropped at this point, okay? And the fact that we've had the U.S. economy that has had difficulty getting off, we've had people whose budgets have been squeezed by the fact that gas has been for I can't remember how long at almost $4 a gallon. The kind of break that it would be if oil goes and descends substantially, okay, all right, over the next 12 months, 18 months, because diffusing of these tensions in the Middle East, okay, because then nobody thinks that we're going to go to frickin' war with Iran, okay, which has been like a lot of people maybe thinking. I mean, it's going to provide a big boost to a lot of people, to the average, you know, American's wallet, okay, and to the economy. Guys, I mean, this is, you know, these morons that are poo-pooing the deal, screw you, man. You know, you guys want, you know, you just want, like, Iran to capitulate under your thumb because, you know, well, actually what they wanted was to go to war, okay? Yeah,
and a lot of them are almost, you know, are willing to say that outright. I mean, what the answer they want, that anything that leads to, like, and it's the same kind of thing we were talking about on Syria. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who their goal is let's go in there and bomb them. And right. Anything that keeps us from doing that is bad. And,
that's right.
And, you know, and maintaining the tensions is good. You know,
right.
You know, and Israel is, you know, Netanyahu and his folks are very upset about this. They don't want us to make friends with Iran. Like, Israel's worst nightmare is a normalization of relationships between Iran and the United States. Yeah, maybe but not I their really worst think, nightmare, but it's a pretty bad nightmare for them.
Well, I don't think that it's a general impression of all Israelis. I think it's Netanyahu's impression.
Well, and that is who I'm speaking of. I'm not speaking of Israelis in general. I would not want to make that generalization.
I mean, Netanyahu doesn't want that, but to be honest with you, Netanyahu's a moron, too, because I don't see... I mean, I'm sorry. If we have better relations with Iran, I think it is a very net positive for the world at large. Okay? I really do. It really helps our cause against terrorism. It helps our economy. It helps us reach out to basically, I mean, I think most Middle Eastern countries have a deep distrust to the United States for very many good reasons,
yep.
Which I think that Iran, having a good relationship with Iran, could help bridge to a certain, a significant amount.
And by the way, it'll, you know, I'm not predicting that we'll be best buds, you know, six
no,
months
I'm not
from
saying
now,
we're gonna be best
but
buds,
the lessening of tensions is the first step to any of that.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely.
I mean, how many decades did us take to, it didn't take us to normalize relationships with Vietnam, but we did.
And now look where we are with Vietnam. I mean, what the hell? Might as well be best buddies, for God's sakes. I mean, really, and not exaggerating. So,
yeah. And so, you know, I think, you know, and we talked before, I mean, about this is Obama, you know, we've talked many times about the many things that I've violently disagree with that Obama's doing. But one of the things that I think he is doing well is he does not have a hesitancy to, like, if he sees a route to get an outcome that he likes, he's not afraid to go against the grain to say, okay, we'll talk to Iran. Okay,
right.
We'll make a deal with Syria. You know,
sure.
And by the way, the deal with Syria seems to be going okay so far, too.
Exactly right.
If you measure it in terms of, okay, we're actually eliminating chemical weapons and stuff, as opposed to measuring it by, you know...
We topple... Well, what's his name?
Assad.
Assad's dead.
I give him credit for these, and we'll see how they work out. I mean, this could be like... You know, if he manages to pull off, you know, I don't know the right word. Normalization is the wrong word probably, but if he manages to pull off de-escalating with Iran and making that into, you know, even if we don't become best buds or remove all the sanctions or whatever, if we drain out some of the tension from that relationship, that's a huge success.
I would say that
if it has economic ramifications to help boost the economy as well, bonus. Of course, last week we were talking about how raising the price of oil might be good for a number of things. But, you know, hey, short-term lowering, okay, cool. You know, this is potentially a big win for him. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, there's been all kinds of, you know, the healthcare rollout disaster and all that kind of stuff. If all that, like, you know, okay, they takes a year to work out all the kinks, by the end of his presidency, that's probably also going to be like, you know, something that he can put a big thumbs up around, because,
well,
you know,
let me put it to you this way. Normalizing relations with Iran is probably like what, one of the biggest foreign policy changes that the United States has had since what, the collapse of the Berlin Wall?
Yeah, probably.
I'm going to say, yeah. So, you know, I mean, that would be huge to any president. So,
okay. Anyway. Enough about Iran. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about a couple other things. Back after this.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
Okay, we're back. Okay, you want to do Arafat first or 2016 first?
Well, let's do Arafat since we're talking the Middle East. Well, okay, so earlier I had read this blurb, and Sam reminded me this blurb, that I guess they exhumed Arafat's body and that they had run some tests again in his body, and they found
some... And by the way, his body was taken to Switzerland. It wasn't just, you know, some Palestinians doing the test and you don't know. It's a reputable third party.
Yeah, and apparently the tests revealed that there were some very highly elevated levels of... What the heck was it?
I believe it was polonium, which is a highly radioactive material, which, if you remember right, there was there were a few people killed by polonium, or assassinated by polonium a couple years back.
There
was a Russian defector.
There's a Russian, right.
One who was not killed, but someone who was running for president in one of the former Soviet republics.
Right. I remember that. Yeah.
You saw before and after pictures, and his face was absolutely devastated. And he survived, but like he was permanently scarred by this. And I think he won anyway, but he was an anti... you know, someone who is more, I think he won. I don't know. But the candidate was in favor of increased relationships with the West as opposed to with Russia. And so both of those were pinned on, okay, that's got to be the Russians doing that. And this is sort of the same modus operandi there, but I'm not sure that the Russians had the motivation here. Most people seem to think if this was truly an assassination, then it was most likely the Israelis. But no one really knows, because there's no evidence of anything beyond... In fact, they've said they can't even definitively say with 100% certainty that he was poisoned, but they can say that the levels of radioactive polonium were quite a few times higher than what one would expect to happen naturally.
But here's a question.
Which is consistent with poisoning.
Well, my question is, you know, why didn't anybody like really like suspect that at the time he died?
Did it wait? Lots of people did.
Lots of people thought
he might have been poisoned. Okay.
Because I think people thought he died, but the thing is, of course, we were discussing like who would have done it, and you were mentioning the Israelis. Which, listen, I don't doubt that the Israelis would have been interested in doing that. Okay, but I I also think that that's too simple an answer. Too. Yeah, there were plenty of other people too.
I mean, the reason people point at the Israelis is because they've actually, you know, admitted openly in a variety of forums to reporters and various other things that over quite a few years they made many attempts to kill Yasser Arafat. And this includes the man who's now in a coma. What's his name? Who's the Israeli leader who is in
Gosh.
Not Rabin. Rabin was killed, right?
No, God, I can't remember, but I know.
Anyway, whoever it was, the person who was Israeli prime minister at the time of Arafat's death was actually on the record with reporters admitting to having tried to kill Arafat multiple times previously. Now, he was not on the record after the death saying, we did that. But he was on the record as having said they'd made multiple attempts.
Sharon.
And it would have been a great success for them if they had killed him. So it's a natural to think, well, maybe they finally succeeded. But again, there's no proof of anything. And there are plenty of other people that didn't like him, too.
Yeah, that's my point.
And maybe it was the Russians. Like I said, it's the Russians' MO.
Yeah. I mean, that's the one thing I'm thinking. It's like, I mean, it just... It is the Russians' MO. That's why I'm like, I don't know what they you know, specifically they sought to gain, but yeah, it would be the Russians' MO.
Yeah, so I'm looking at an article on NPR dated November 10th called Lighting Up the Investigative Path with Polonium-210, and it just mentions one of these other scenarios. We mentioned the Russian dissident. It's so they were talking about this. Andrei Lugiev and Dmitry Kovtun, and I'm massacring those pronunciations, of course, ordered gin, and a 43-year-old Russian dissident named Alexander Litvinenko drank green tea. As far as he was concerned, it was a business meeting with two old acquaintances. He goes home to his little house with his wife, has a chicken dinner, watches the Russian evening news, and then goes to bed. It was a normal night. But within hours, he began having bouts of severe vomiting. He knew immediately that he had been poisoned. He called his wife for an ambulance. He goes to the local hospital, tells the doctors, I've been poisoned by Russian spies. Of course, they suggest he calls a psychiatrist because he had had sushi for lunch. So they were like, it's food poisoning. You've just been poisoned by bad sushi. But days passed. His condition worsened. He was put on a feeding tube. He started losing his hair. Antibiotics were administered. Tests for AIDS, hepatitis, all negative. Doctors were at a loss. 2 weeks later, they figured out it was polonium-210 coursing through his body. It has a half-life of 138 days, highly radioactive. And they say, for a while, it's hissing and spitting with radiation and energy. Then it burns itself out. And he knew what it was before he died, but there was absolutely nothing they could do.
But here's my question. How did he give it to the person? How did he?
He drank it. It was in the tea.
It was in the tea.
You just put it in a liquid. They drink it. It's done. And what they say is here, even if they diagnosed it earlier, there would have been no cure. There's nothing they can do. You're done. You know, it'll kill you in a couple weeks.
Oh, that's brutal.
You basically go from being perfectly healthy to having, you know, well, it's radiation poisoning, but it basically your cells all start to die from the radiation poisoning.
That's one brutal way of killing somebody. Okay. Jeez. Yeah. Okay. Well.
Anyway, think this might have been what killed Arafat too. And maybe it was the Russians, maybe it was the Israelis. Hell, maybe it was
somebody
us.
Else. Maybe it was us. That's what I'm saying. I'm like, who the hell knows? I mean, you know.
Just like we were all speculating on who did the Stuxnet virus targeting Iran. Was it Israelis? Right. Is it us? Is it whatever? Turns out it was both the Israelis and us. It's one of those things, I guess. And this is another one of those places where they say everybody does it. But come on. Everybody shouldn't do it. And we should be mad. Even if he was an asshole and we don't like him, we should still be mad. This is, you know, it's not like at the time he died. He was no longer sort of, there was a period in time where he was an active terrorist resistor to the Israeli occupation.
Correct. But he was not anymore. So that's why
he died. He was running the Palestinian Authority. There'd been peace treaties signed. There were things going on. And, you know, there were indications that, you know, he wanted to regularize relationships.
That's why I'm like, listen, Sharon was one of the guys. Listen, this happened when Sharon was alive. And Sharon, despite the fact that I know that Sharon had admitted to trying to assassinate him many times, times. He had been very actively seeking peace with Arafat, and he had done a lot of things that were very counter to what a lot of people in Israel were, you know, thought was, you know, he had done things basically to try to push a peace that were very favorable to, you know, that the people in Israel didn't like, period. Okay. And so I don't know.
Well, and speaking of, you know, who knows what is where, you also have elements that clearly do not like the process moving towards peace. That's the one result they don't want to happen. And so it could have been one of those. I don't remember the exact political situation surrounding the time that he died. It wasn't as bright and shiny roses as it was earlier. It had already started to deteriorate some. But, you know, I don't know. But, yeah, this is the kind of thing where, you know, the U.S., if we at all cared about what we say are our values and our morals, we should be upset about this. We should be all about, we need a full investigation. We need to find out who's responsible, and they should go to jail. They should be punished for it, you know, and if it was the Israeli government, there should be sanctions against them. You know, I don't know, but of course, that's not the world we live in. But I find that unfortunate because I feel like, you know, I want to have a government that I can feel proud of living up to high standards and with, you know, all of the spying stuff we've been talking about lately, this kind of stuff. I mean, not saying we know that we did this. We probably didn't. But, you know, I just am not feeling all the warm and fuzzies about, you know, feeling confident that we do the right things and we're consistent in our moral values or anything like that. Let alone where I'd like to be. Because, I mean, honestly, I've been meaning to mention this for the last few shows, but the more and more, as I age and more of this I see, the more and more I'm thinking, you know, I'm coming around to the pacifist position, you know, where more and more I'm thinking, you know, really, there's no excuse that we have to resort to violence for this or for that or for this. You know,
I'm not going to say that I'm completely a pacifist, but I will say this, that I think that aggression or anything is a ridiculous last resort to self-defense. I was against, like, the war in Iraq. I was against, like, you know, look, after September 11th, the fact that we went in Afghanistan and tried to get, you know, went after specifically people that we knew that had attacked us, I'm okay with that. But other than that, I mean, I'm thinking of acts that we've done the last 20, 30 years, going into Panama, like going into Grenada, a lot of this stuff.
Like I said, I'm moving more and more to the pacifist position, but at the very least, I agree with you. There needs to be an incredibly high bar. We need to really and truly believe there is no other alternative. And, like, you know, and if I was president, which of course will never happen, but, like, one of the things I would like to declare right up front is, look, you know, my government will not engage in actions with lethal intent unless there was a formal declaration of war or we are directly being attacked.
If you get to be president, can I just be the Treasury Secretary? That's all I want.
Because you want your signature on the money.
Yeah.
I can understand that. Yeah. Okay, let's take another break. We'll come back. We'll wrap it up with the election 2013 and the implications for 2016. We'll be right back.
This is a break. Oh, yes, this is a break. This is a break because no one gave me any suggestions. I told you. I warned you, so this is a break. This is a wonderful break, a wonderful break. Yes, indeed, this is a break. This is a break in the middle of Curmudgeon's Corner. Yes, this is a break. Yes, yes, this is a break. Break, 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 break. Yes, 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 this is a break. Yes, this is a break. Break, 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 break. Yes, it is a break. And now the break is over.
Okay, we're back.
As you can see, we're chomping at the bit at getting to 2016 at some point. Actually, I don't want to get that old that fast. All right, can I be honest with you right now? You know, look.
You know, this time flies so bad. We just had the last election. I just tweeted a couple days ago because it's November 8th, 2016 is the election. We're now less than 3 years from that. You know, and it's only a matter of time till it's less than 2 years, less than 1 year. It'll be here before you know it.
2016? I mean, really? Fuck, I mean, do you realize how old we're going to be when it's the fucking 2016 election around?
Well, you know what what makes you feel even older is I've seen a couple bumper stickers, and this was going around on the internet, too.
What? Yeah.
No, the thing about, you know, the Democrats have it all planned out. 2016 Hillary, 2020 Hillary, 2024
Michelle,
and then 2028 Michelle, and then I think they had the Obama girls. You know, after
oh,
that.
Oh God.
You know, and
No, Chelsea.
Oh yeah, Chelsea was in there. It was Chelsea was before Michelle, so it was Hillary, Chelsea. Then Michelle, and then the Obama girls. And they had it all planned out to like 2060 or something.
Oh, there you go. Beautiful. There you go. Oh, God. Jesus Christ. No, I don't want to get so old. I don't know. Okay.
Yeah, so anyway, there were two races that sort of got national attention.
Well, you know, fat boy over here in New Jersey, where I'm at right now, Christie. Okay, you know, it's like I don't know. I'll make a fat joke, but actually, you know, here's the thing about Chris Christie. Chris Christie, they call him. He's like the new. Would he be? Wait a minute. Who's the fattest president we had? Wasn't it Taft?
Taft.
Because but he's big.
He's been losing lots of weight in the last 6 months. He's getting fit to run for president.
Well, that would probably be a good thing because, Jesus, poor guy. But now, I will say this. I like Christie, okay, to be honest with you, compared to most of the other wacko Republicans that there are.
So let's talk about, like, the two races real quick, and we'll talk about both of them. There was the governor's race in New Jersey that we were talking about. Christie won against some no-name Democrat. And then in Virginia, the Democrat, Terry McAuliffe, who used to work in the Clinton administration, won by a hair. Well, by 2.5 points, one over Ken Cuccinelli, which was who identified himself sort of as a Tea Party Republican in Virginia. But everybody expected it to be a clear McAuliffe win, but instead it was very, very close.
Can't remember that the other guy did some stuff. McAuliffe did
stuff. McAuliffe apparently is a complete scumbag. So, like, right. You know, I heard there were some people on Twitter, and I think I retweeted them, basically saying, you can tell me these results just how much people did not want to vote for McAuliffe. And if right. The Republicans had put up anybody who they felt comfortable with, like a more centrist Republican, the Republicans would have won easily.
Right.
And the only reason the Republicans didn't win is because they put on somebody who is fairly right wing.
But that's been like the discussion that they've been having with everybody, because the problem is that the Republicans right now are saying, well, you've got a wing of the Republican Party that's trying to make everything pure now.
Yes.
We only want candidates with a purity. And the problem is that if that's the case, then this is the result you're going to get. They're not going to win. I mean, people are – there was this article that I posted, tweeted, I think it was today, about the centrists just getting like fed up.
Right.
There's a that there is a very big cross section of America, which I do believe, because I have heard this a lot. Okay, and I that it's just fed up with this shit. Okay, that just can't. They're just, you know, it's just irritating, and they don't want these damn idiot pure candidates that these morons are pushing. But that's what they are saying. We need to get pure.
Well, so
now, Chris Christie is going away. Who's saying? Listen, this purity thing is just, you know what, it's just killing us. Either we make ourselves a more inclusive party or we're fucked.
So what's interesting here with Christie, the McAuliffe-Cuccinelli thing says that potentially things aren't quite as clear-cut, you know, Democrats are doing whatever as they thought they were, in Virginia at least. But the one in New Jersey, I think, is more interesting because one of the things he won by a large margin in a state that is traditionally a Democratic state. It always right. votes for Democratic presidents or has for a long time. He won with a nice, healthy margin here. And what kind of Republican is he? He's the most centrist Republican with a national voice at the moment.
That's
and,
exactly
and so you immediately had a lot of the sort of establishment folks starting to talk about how well, Christie's clearly the front runner here. This is how a Republican can win. This is how a Republican can win in a blue state. This is what you need in order to win. And so there are people declaring him the front runner in 2016. Now, I'll talk about some caveats for this for the moment. Now, if I had to predict it this very second, the pattern the Republicans have had over the last couple of election cycles, and you could argue going back even further, is that you have an establishment candidate that the establishment rallies around very early, and then you have a whole bunch of candidates representing different segments of the base. And those other candidates divide the base. They can never come together. And eventually the establishment candidate wins, even though the majority of Republicans perhaps don't even want him.
But here's the problem also with what they've done. They've wound up pushing the candidate. Okay, the last couple of cycles also what they
wound up pushing
the candidate over to positions that he would have never, ever supported, which is what Chris Christie is trying to avoid.
So this is the exact pattern here. Is that the centrist candidate gets essentially nominated in the invisible primary by the money people and the donors and the establishment, and they all back up behind him. He gets into the primaries. The people who are anti-establishment, be they the religious conservatives or the libertarian conservatives or the this conservatives or the that conservatives, they all divide up the rest of the vote. So the establishment candidate gets the most delegates and ends up winning. But in order to get there, in order to not be just tossed out completely of the Republican primary process, they have to go way to the right and convince enough of those base people
that they don't want gay marriage, they don't want health care, they don't like, you know, they don't like,
they will never compromise on taxes,
and never compromise on anything. Read my lips.
Go back to George H.W. Bush, no new
taxes. You know, no new taxes, blah, 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 all that fucking bullshit.
And so what they end up with then is they
immigration, fuck you, we're going to build a fence, a huge one,
you know. They end up going into the general election with a candidate that is compromised by all of this because they have a hard time reaching the middle. Now, having said that, you know, it's not like there haven't been close elections. I mean, W's election was relatively close both times. George, you know,
okay, but remember something: W was a centrist compared to these people.
Well, I know
W.
He won the exact same way. We're not just talking Romney and McCain. W won in 2000 the same kind of triangulation. He was the what was it? Compassionate conservative.
That was exactly right.
You know, he ran as the moderate. And he got the establishment nomination the same way. And right. Frankly, you know, he lost the popular vote. You know, in 2000, and the dynamics are different when you have an incumbent. Yes, Alex. I'm almost done, but not quite. Okay. So, hold on. I'm not quite done talking to Yvonne, okay? You want to stay there? Here, have a cookie. You want a cookie? No. Okay. Anyway, he's not the... this is the pattern the Republicans have been having essentially since Ronald Reagan. I mean, George H.W. Bush was that kind of candidate. Dole was that kind of candidate.
That's right.
This is what the Republicans have been doing for 20 years. So the big question, as it is every 4 years, is will the Republicans get into a cycle where they will break out of this pattern and instead do a Goldwater? You know, and we know how it worked out for Goldwater, but you know, this is the alternative is say we're not going to nominate the moderate consensus candidate. Instead, we're going to nominate somebody who's more ideologically pure.
I do think that that's what a lot of Republicans want. Okay, all right, especially if you're talking about the Republican base.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I think they say right now they want.
And you know, frankly, like, you know, in terms of predictions, you know, and I guess we have to say we're still on the Democratic side depends, you know, I think if I had to bet right now, and it's way too long, I wouldn't bet very much, but I would bet we end up with something like Christie versus Clinton. or Bush versus Clinton with Jeb, or something like that, where we do have the moderate Republican again. But here's my thought. That is, again, it's the only way the Republicans have a shot. I'm not saying they would win, but if they run somebody who's a moderate Republican, or as the base calls them, rhinos, Republicans in name only, then they have a shot. If they nominate, Cruz or Ryan or Rand Paul or any of these guys that you hear being talked about, guess what? They're going to get crushed.
They're going to nominate Tom Cruise?
Not Tom Cruise.
Oh, Ted. Oh, okay, sorry.
Ted Cruz, yes.
Okay, that guy, okay.
But yeah. Well,
that would be kind of crazy, too, if they nominated Tom Cruise. But anyway, all right.
Yeah, he is kind of crazy. But, like, yeah, I could see, you know, a Jeb Bush could be competitive. Although I think people are tired. Yeah, I don't know. The name still has some poison around it. But for that matter, the Clinton name still has some poison around it.
Jeb Rhino, okay, is a problem. Okay, so according to everybody. So, look,
this is, again, where does the Republican war end up? Do the rebels end up winning? And I think, you know, it comes down to the same thing as I think the reason that these upstart Republicans haven't won for any of these last election cycles that we've been talking about is because they can't come together on a single candidate that makes all of those factions happy. You can come up with the libertarian Republican. You can come up with the religious conservative Republican, but you can't come up with somebody that makes both of those happy very easy. So you end up with the moderate Republican that makes none of them happy ends up winning. You know, it's exactly what we saw with all of these.
I think the Republicans are going to go thermonuclear this election cycle. That's my gut feeling like right now. That could change depending on what the dynamics are by the middle of midterm elections. What could change them is, look, what happens if, like, you know, the calculus would change if they get crushed in the midterms. Okay.
Right.
Say, for example.
Well, I think, and one of the reasons that the pattern has been what it is follow the money. The candidates who end up being ahead in the cycle are the ones who end up with the most resources. Who are the ones that end up with the most resources? It's the ones who make Wall Street happy.
Here's the thing right now. Look, the money is going in that direction, but you've got – but like you said before, you have the guys at the fringe not coalescing around a candidate, right? The Wall Street money right now doesn't want these guys. They're fed up with them, okay? All right?
Wall Street's not going to pour a bunch of money into Santorum.
No. They're or Cruz or any of these idiots. Okay, they're done.
Now
okay?
they might they're, put money into Christie.
They would put money into Christie. Okay, but the reality is, like we're just saying, if the
and by the way, we haven't mentioned Rubio yet. Nobody's been talking about Rubio in a long time.
Like, right.
He's sort of faded a bit.
Yeah, but if for example they go and they wind up coalescing around one guy and they wind up going and like basically tearing the party apart, you're going to wind up with, you know how the process is in Republicans. The process is very heavily tilted toward those guys being able to push their candidate through. The reason they had won the nomination before was because those guys were so fragmented. If they come together around one wacko and do their Goldwater moment, they're going to be fucked. And the money people are not going to be able to get out of it. So I don't know. But like I said, like right now, I got to look. I really believe that a lot of that dynamic will be driven by what happens in the midterms. Okay, all right, for the House.
Yeah.
Because if a lot of these people, the ones that were all last month pushing for fire and mayhem, if a lot of those guys get crushed, okay, all right, because of what they did, then you know what? Then this is a moot point. Then you're going to wind up really with a centrist because these guys get routed. Okay. That's the reality. And we won't know that really for 12 months because the impact of some of the stuff that's happening right now, the healthcare, the other stuff and whatever, you know what it is, memories are fickle, you know, whatever, you know, by the time we get around to the election, I posted a poll recently about attitudes about the NSA and like spying about Americans.
It's like 60% approve of it.
Exactly. And the number, by the way, consistent over the last...
It made me sad to see, but I'm not surprised.
But not surprised. But, you know, I'm saying it's not surprised. It's been a steady number. It didn't change, like, one frickin' bit, even with all this drumbeat of revelations, okay? So the reality is that unless we see a change, like, in terms of people's attitudes, if they go to the polls and they vote a lot of these people out because they're pissed, and because of some of the stuff that happened, but by then, maybe a lot of the stuff they'll forget. They'll forget about the whole Obamacare fiasco by then. They'll forget about all this stuff. They'll get to the election with a fresh respect to what's then. If the economy's good and all this stuff and whatever, and these guys are all, like, freaking railing for destruction, they may get their asses kicked. They may get not. Who knows? But I really, you know, I think that will really either empower these guys to go for the full push or just chasing them because they get their asses kicked. That's what I think really is the bigger driver there. So right now it's too far out to tell because I don't know.
Well, and the other theory, of course, is the next in line theory of Republican politics, which has worked the last couple times around too. McCain was next in line after Bush. Romney was next in line after McCain.
And who was after Romney, then?
If we follow that same logic, it would be Santorum. Santorum was the last one to be mathematically eliminated in the Republican race last time around.
Oh, well, mathematically eliminated, but really, who had, but there was somebody
he,
else.
He was the last one standing besides Romney.
Yeah, but that's just because he decided to not pull out till the end. I mean, if I went through the vote.
In terms of the delegate race, too, he was second, almost the entire race.
Really?
Starting, Yeah, I mean, he was next in line in delegates to Romney
Who won Iowa? I can't remember who the heck won the first few things.
Ron Paul won Iowa.
So I'm thinking more along those lines.
Well, remember Iowa in terms of the quote unquote vote was a three way tie, and there was all this stuff. In terms of delegates, it ended up being Ron Paul because of his caucus organization. In terms of popular vote. Remember, it was declared to be Romney. Then it turned out that Santorum had actually won by like two or three votes, but it was too late. Then it was declared to be Romney, so done. you know, but of course, popular vote doesn't matter in caucus states and whatever. Anyway, and then on the Democratic side, we of course have continued to say, you know, Hillary, Hillary, Hillary. There were a few articles this last week about basically Hillary not so fast. Basically pointing out that there are, you know, it's right now everybody is Hillary, Hillary, Hillary based on name recognition, but there are other alternatives out there that if Hillary stumbled or fell or did anything, or let alone if she decides not to run, that are out there are significant, like significant portions of the base, for instance, might like Elizabeth Warren better than they like Hillary. You know, there's, of course, there's Biden, but I think he's less exciting. There's, who's there? Klobuchar, however you say her name. There are a number of people out there who are potentially very interesting to the Democratic base. And if a lot of folks start seeing Hillary as, you know, going back to the old days of more centrist Democrats. And by the way, you know, everybody always pushes, you know, Bill and Hillary being these big, huge, horrible liberals. The reality is they were centrist Democrats. Their whole deal getting into Democrats was that whole third way of compromising between the old liberals. And, you know, that's how they won back in 1992. But anyway, it's not all wrapped up on the Democratic side either. I think, you know, if Hillary wants it, she probably still has it. But, you know, there are things that can happen. I'd give her a 95% shot, you know. If she wants it, she's got 95%.
I think if she wants it, she's going to get it. Bottom line.
I think that is somebody calculated. I posted an article, actually, that said, I just said she's got a 95% chance if she decides to run. Somebody actually calculated that the actuarial odds of her dying before the 2016 election, just of normal situations, are about 4%.
Or about 4%.
Given her age, her health, everything. Actually, they said it was 4% for just a woman her age. But given some of the known family history, it's actually probably less than that. Because, you know, her mom lived into the late 90s and things like that and whatever. So, and they actually calculated that and compared it to other candidates because people were talking about, is Hillary too old? And her odds are actually about equivalent, you know, to... certainly McCain's odds were not any better.
She's a woman. I mean, they have longer lifespans and so forth. And
yeah,
so,
exactly. Yeah, exactly. Right. Somebody calculated all those odds. It was kind of an entertaining, or look at my Twitter. You'll see that. But no, if she decides to run, which I think she will, but if she decides to run, she almost certainly has it absent a major health issue or some unforeseen scandal that comes up that we don't know about today. And those kinds of things can always happen. And that's what accounts for the 5% I'm saying. If she doesn't decide to run, it'll be chaos in the Democratic Party. There'll be all kinds of people going for it. And, you know, frankly, if she doesn't run, then we're going to have just as much fun in 2016 as we had in 2008 with wide open races in both parties. It'll be fun to watch. But yeah, we'll see how it goes.
All right, we got to sign off. We're done.
Yeah, we're done. It'll be interesting to watch. You know, I've done a few links to my preliminary poll information, but it is so preliminary. There's not enough data there to come to any real conclusions. Like the obscure candidates actually look like they'll do better against Clinton than people who are well known. Why? Because there's no polling on them. There's one poll in one state or whatever. You know, I mentioned Elizabeth Warren. There haven't been any polls with her. Yeah. You know, so, you know, anyway, interesting stuff. Way too early to really tell. If I had to bet right now, and I would not bet very much, I think it's going to be Christie versus Hillary, and Hillary will win.
I like that. I'm going to second that motion.
You know, all the caveats, way too early. I will probably have a different prediction in 6 months to a year. But if you forced me to predict right now, that's what I would predict. Okay, we're done. Thanks, everybody. Email me, abelsmay@abelsmay.com. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Abelsmay. Yvonne's I am Bo. All that stuff. Review us. Send us feedback. Tell your friends. You know the deal. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good week, and we'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.